Okay. I want to cover a few topics. I don't know how many we'll get to, but first one, the Yikuli Truma. Truma is a donation. You don't take a donation, you give a donation. It should have said the Yitnuli Truma. They should give me a donation. Not they should take from me a donation. So why is the Lashon the Yikhu instead of the Yitnu? There are other answers to this question, but one of them is the following. The Gemara says, Turnus Rufus HaRosha asked Rabbi Akiva the following question. If God loves poor people so much, why doesn't he support them? Why does he tell other people to support them? If he loves them so much, why didn't he support them? So Rabbi Akiva said, of course God could support the Ani. The purpose of tzedakah is not for the sake of the Ani. Because if God was concerned about the Ani, he'd give him money. Why does he give the rich man extra money and tell him to give it to the Ani? Cut out the middleman. The purpose is for us, said Rabbi Akiva, to save us from Gehenna, to give us a schus. The Rabban Shom wants us to have the schus to be able to support the Ani for the sake of the rich man, not for the sake of the poor man. For the sake of the poor man, the Rabban Shom could take care of him. And that's why the Gemara says, Yoser mimashehe osher oseim ha'ani. More than the osher does for the Ani, he'ani oseim ha'osher. The Ani does for the osher. Because the osher only gives the Ani money which God could give him. The Ani gives the Asher a mitzvah, which even God can't give, because HaKol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Meira Shemayim. The Ani affords the rich person something that even God can't give him, that he has to get on his own. And we learned that from Ruth. Ruth, when she spent the day taking the free things that an Ani is allowed to take from the field, leket, shikha, peya, right, all the matnas aniyim. So she came home to Naomi, and Naomi said, where were you today? Where did you get all this free food? She said, ha'ish asher asisi mohayom, the man I did for today was Boaz. What'd she do for him? He did for her. So we learn from there, she did more for Boaz than Boaz did for her. Boaz gave her food. God could have given her food. She gave Boaz a mitzvah, which only, what's it called, the Rabban Shom can't give you mitzvahs, that you have to do on your own. So she enabled Boaz to have that mitzvah. And if you think about it, right, it's clear like that. Right? It's clear to think that the Rabban Shom needs you to give an Ani money, right? And he's begging you, please give this Ani money, he gives you a mitzvah, and God can't give it to him directly? Forget about you. Why does he have to bother me? Give it to him directly. It must be for my sake. And therefore it's even more ridiculous to think. God says, look, I want to build a Mishkan. Could you spare some gold, silver, whatever? We could use some material so we could build a Mishkan. The Rabban Shom can create gold, silver. He owns everything. Why does he have to ask us to give him gold and silver? Well, the answer is not for the sake of the Mishkan. It's for the sake of giving us a schus to do it. And that answers also another question that bothered me, even though this week in my drasha I'm going to say a different answer to this question. So it's hard for me to focus in on the answer I'm going to tell you now, which is what I said in the past. But if you think about it, it sounds ridiculous. Right? For usually, you have a goal to do. Okay, I want to build a house. Okay, I want to build a house. I have to go buy materials. I need wood. I need cement. I need bricks. Whatever. Okay? What's the normal order? First, I want to build a house, then I have to go buy the materials. So the parsha should have said, V'osali mikdash, let's build a mikdash, and now we need materials, so could you contribute gold, silver, and all the 13 materials are needed for a mishkan? It doesn't say that. It says, take an offering, get me gold, silver, whatever. Why? Because we want to build a mishkan. If the order is reversed, you don't go around and say, oh, I've got to get ingredients, I've got to get materials. Why? Oh, I don't know yet, but we're going to do something with it. And then you decide, well, now they have all these materials, let's build a house. It works the other way. First you have the desire to build a house, now you need materials to build your house. The Torah should have said, we want to build a Mishkan, now we need materials to build the Mishkan. Instead of, first, donate materials. For what? Doesn't say. Now we have the materials, let's build the Mishkan. Because the materials were not for the sake of the Mishkan. If the purpose is to build a Mishkan, God doesn't need your materials. The purpose is to give you a schus to be able to enable you to build a Mishkan. That's the thing. And therefore, the same thing goes with supporting Torah. The Aron carried the people who carried it. It looked like they were carrying and supporting the Aron. But in fact, the Aron was supporting them. It looks like the Asher is supporting the Ani, but the Ani is really supporting the Asher by giving him that schus. The Chofetz Chaim says that's the meaning of the pasuk: Eitz Chaim hi lemachazikim ba v'tomcheha me'ushar. There's two ways to look at supporting Torah. One way is called tomcheha, people who support the Torah and think that they're supporting the Torah. Okay, I am helping out Torah institutions. I'm supporting Torah. Those people are fortunate, but it's not a tree of life for them. Who is it a tree of life for? L'machazikim bo. The word l'hachazik means to support, but it also means to hold on for dear life. When you're drowning and somebody throws you a life preserver, or you're drowning and a log floats by and you hold on to it for dear life, that's called l'hachazik, to hold on to it for dear life. A person who knows that when he supports Torah, it's basically he's the one who's benefiting. Torah can get along without you, but the Rabbanu Shalom made it that the Torah needs you for your sake, just like he made the Ani need so the Asher can be able to get a schus. So that kind of person, the Torah is an Eitz Chaim l'machazikim bo. But the people who think they're supporting the Torah, they're ma'ushar, they're going to get rewarded for it. They're fortunate. But they're not, for them it's not a tree of life. That's why, again, the Aron, people carried the Aron. Looks like they were carrying it, but the truth is the Aron carried them. The Chofetz Chaim was very true to what he said. Somebody once came to the Chofetz Chaim and offered him to underwrite the entire budget of Radin Yeshiva. Whatever he couldn't raise, this person will make up the deficit. The whole thing, the whole budget. The Chofetz Chaim said, I appreciate your offer, I can't accept it. I said, what, something wrong with my money? He said, no, I'll explain to you. Really, God could take care of my budget very easily. Right? So why doesn't he? Because he wants Klal Yisrael to have a share in my yeshiva. I can't let you take the whole thing for yourself. You have to share it with other people. So that, if somebody offered me that, I definitely would take it. But in any case, the Chofetz Chaim said, I believe that the Rabbanu Shalom can support my yeshiva. So why doesn't he? Because he wants to give the schus to other people. I can't let you hog that schus for yourself. You can have a portion of it. You can't have the whole thing. I assume that the Panavizhar Rav would have done something different. He would have taken the money and built another yeshiva. He can do that that way too. There's a maisa that is said that the founder of Telzer Yeshiva, Reb Lazer Gordon, who was then later known as Reb Lazer Telzer, when he got married, so he was a young man, and he had showed very great promise of being one of the future Gedolei Yisrael. His father-in-law was a Rav in Eishishak. A Rav, not a wealthy man, but he wanted to promote his son-in-law to help him to be able to develop into a very big Talmud Chacham. So he wanted him to be able to learn without having the problems of Parnassa for the first 5 years of his marriage. So in those days, they didn't support them. They lived with the in-laws. They ate at their table. They didn't pay any rent or anything. So they had basically no expenses. And 5 years went by, and he got an offer to be a Rav in a certain place. And he told his wife, you know, your father agreed that we should eat at his table and live with him for 5 years. 5 years are up. I've gotten this offer, and I want you to go to your father and ask his permission that we should be able to leave and to thank him for supporting us for 5 years. She went to her father, and she told him, and he turned white, And he said, no, you can't leave. You have to stay another 5 years. And if it's that you don't, I'm not giving you enough, or what, I'll give you more. You have to stay another 5 years. She went back to her husband. She said, my father was terrified of the fact that we're going to leave. He wants us to stay another 5 years. He said, okay, look, we have a few children. It's not, you know, like in the beginning. It's hard for them. They're not rich people. I feel uncomfortable. Things were very different then. I feel uncomfortable doing this, but, you know, if that's what your father wants, we'll stay another 5 years. At the end of that 5 years, they're already married 10 years. They have children growing up, expensive. And he then got a very prestigious offer to be a Rav somewhere. And he wanted to take the job, but he didn't need permission again from his father-in-law. Sent his wife in again and to ask permission to go. This time, the mother-in-law was also there, the wife's mother. And she said, you know, it's 10 years already. We have a growing family. It's not easy for you to continue supporting us. My husband has been offered a very prestigious rabbonus. We want permission to leave. So the wife said to the father, you know, she's right. How long can we continue supporting them? And the husband said, I don't know who's supporting who, but I won't stand in the way of my son-in-law's career. And if he has this prestigious offer, he should go with a bracha. The day they left, that father-in-law died. And the mother-in-law then understood what he meant. I don't know who's supporting who. So sometimes you think that you're supporting other people when in fact the mitzvah that you're doing supports you. So that is why it says v'yikhu li truma. Who's really the taker over here? Not the people who are giving to the Mishkan. God isn't the recipient. Oh, I need your gold and silver so we can build the Mishkan. I want you to give gold and silver so you will get a schus. So v'yikhu li truma. By giving that donation, you are taking for yourself. You're not giving me anything because I have it all. And I can create gold and silver if I wanted to. I want to give you the merit of giving it. So your giving is really taking. Okay. There's a lot more to talk about this, but we will save it till Parshas Vayakel and or Kisisa, one of the two, and we'll keep this idea in mind. We're going to answer a very big question with it about the Nesiim. But it's not in this week's Sedra. It's later on. There's now Sedras one after the other about the Mishkan, so we have plenty of time to catch up things that we won't speak about in Truma. We can speak about in Kisisa and Vayakel and Pekudei. So we have time to make up all the topics I want to talk about. Next topic. Any questions on this? Okay. Next topic. The Aram was gold on the inside and gold on the outside. And it was wood on the in the middle. Okay? The way the Aram was made, Rashi says, there were three boxes. There was a large box of gold, a medium-sized box of wood, and a smaller box of gold. The Aram was basically wood. But the golden box covered the outside of the Aram, so it was covered with gold, and the little box went inside the wooden box and covered from the inside. So mibayis umichutz itzapenu, the Aram was covered on the outside with gold and the inside, and we learn from that that a Talmud Chacham should be tocho kebaro. He should be gold on the inside, gold on the outside. He shouldn't only appear to be gold, he should be gold on the inside, and he shouldn't only be on the inside, people should see that he's also gold on the outside. Says the Das Akademi Bali Atosfos. Wouldn't it have been better if the Aram was solid gold then? Then the symbol would have been much better. A Talmud Chacham should be solid gold. Not just gold on the inside and gold on the outside. It should be gold through and through. Why wasn't it solid gold? So some say because the Aram had to be something alive. Eitz Chayim hi, right? The thing that it had to be wood, which is a living thing. Right? Not gold, which is a non-living thing. So the Aron itself was wood, except it was covered with gold on the inside and outside to show this idea that a Talmud Chacham should be gold on the inside, gold on the outside. That's one idea. Reb Shamshon Feuerl Hirsch, I think it's him, or Rabbi Breuer, his son-in-law, said a different thing. Very nice. He said that gold is malleable. You can change its shape. Wood, you can't change its shape. You can cut it up, but you can't change the shape of the wood. It's rigid. A Talmud Chacham, on the one hand, his base values have to be rigid. Can't change them. But on the outside and inside, he could be malleable. He can be, flexible. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. He can be flexible. There's things to be flexible about that aren't the core values. Core values, you have to be rigid. Otherwise, there's things to be flexible on the outside and the inside. So the outside and the inside was gold, but the middle was wood. Okay. Those are some answers. The Das Akenim says a much more simple answer, but I learned a tremendous mussar from that, and I'll tell you a story that goes along with it. The Das Akenim says, yes, it would have been much more symbolic if the Aron was solid gold. But a box of those dimensions, solid gold, could not have been carried. It was much too heavy. Gold, much too heavy to be carried. And even though the Aron carried the people who carried it, that was a miracle. And in Somchim Alanes, it had to be able to be carried normally. So since it would have been too heavy to be carried, it couldn't be solid gold. It had to be a thin layer of gold on the outside and a thin layer of gold on the inside, but the major part of the Aron was wood. So it could be carried. What did I learn from that? The following story. True story. When I was a rabbi in Miami, there was a girl in the community who she lived together with her mother. She didn't have a father in the picture. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if he died or I never knew what happened to the father, or there was never a father. It was this girl, an only daughter to her mother. Her mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Zero. Mamish. She had no idea what anything Jewish was. Her daughter got involved in NCSY and she became frum. She was about 16 years old at the time. And as Balei Tshuva sometimes are, she like went overboard. I mean, whatever she could have possibly heard or thought, she immediately did. Her mother was a tzaddikus. She wasn't frum. But this woman went along with her daughter, whatever her daughter wanted. Her daughter came home and said, I can't wear one bit of the clothing that I have now. I have to get a completely new wardrobe of clothing that's sanua, right? Even clothing that was no problem with it, but her mother went out and bought her entire, they weren't rich people, entire new wardrobe so she could wear clothing that was sanua. The girl, wanted to eat kosher. The mother koshered the house and only bought kosher food for the daughter. Whatever the daughter came home. But the mother didn't know anything about these things, and some of the things sounded way out, and some of them were. Because the girl didn't understand or didn't know where she... So the mother would call me and say, is this really necessary? My daughter came home today and said she has to do this or that. Right, is it necessary? And sometimes I would tell the mother, yes, that is necessary. That's part of what Judaism is. And sometimes I would tell her, no, it's not really necessary. You could do a little bit differently or whatever. One time the mother calls me, really upset. And she says, Rabbi, aren't you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. She says, then why don't you eat kosher? I said, oh no, what now? So what happened was like this. In Miami at the time, there was a kosher butcher that all the rabbonim basically gave a hechsher to, the Orthodox Rabbinical Council, which I was part of. And the meat was brought in from Denver. There was no local shechita in what's it called in Miami. The closest place where they processed and shechted animals was in Denver. And it was all brought in, what's it called, packaged meat or whatever, to this butcher shop. The only problem was that meat was glatt meat, it was 100% okay, but it wasn't Hasidic Shechita. Hasidic Shechita is nothing to do with halacha, per se, but Hasidim, some, are makbid, that on certain things that they don't accept the meat if it doesn't have certain hidurim, for instance. One of the hidurim, just to give you an example, there are others, but the shochtim have to have beards. Even if they shave in a permissible way, but a shochet without a beard is not, that's not acceptable. doesn't make it a osur. It's just a minute. What's it called? They accepted that hither. Okay, to give you an example of what. So if the shoch, if any of the shochim don't have beers, they don't want that meat. So the community, there was no available source with chassidish shechita that was within the price limits of to be able to get it and to provide it with a decent price for the community. So we opted to get from this place, and even the chassidish rabbonim who were involved gave their hechsher to it. But they personally wanted to eat something more mohoder. So they arranged to bring in meat from chassidish shechita, but since there weren't that many people who wanted it, right, the price was exorbitant. It was about twice the price of the regular meat. You could only bring it in from time to time because it wasn't enough people to bring it in. So they brought in, you had to buy a 4/4 of an animal at a time. Okay? Whoever wanted it. So you had to have a freezer to keep this meat. Okay? You had to travel to a central place about 30 miles outside of Miami to pick it up. You had to buy a freezer to store it, and you had to buy a tremendous amount at one time, and then they brought it in 2 or 3 times a year. That was it. So this girl heard about that, and she told her mother, we can't eat the meat from the regular butcher shop. That's not kosher. Kosher means this meat that's brought in twice, you have to get a freezer, you have to spend twice the price of the meat, and twice a year we'll have it, you have to put it in a freezer or whatever, and you have to drive 30 miles each way to pick it up. So the woman called me and she said, Rabbi, I know you buy your meat in this butcher shop, and you say it's kosher, right? Now you're an Orthodox rabbi, my daughter tells me that meat's not kosher, and she has to get this meat, right, that I have to drive 30 miles each way, pay double the price, and buy a freezer so I can buy a half a cow every time I buy the meat. Now tell me, how come you don't eat kosher meat? So I said, I'll take care of it. I called the girl in, and I said to her the following. I told her this dasa came to me, Baliat Osfus. I said, you know, sometimes it's really nice to be solid gold. But if the people who have to carry you, you're going to be too heavy to carry, then sometimes it's better not to be solid gold. I said, you want to be solid gold, and you want to get this meat that's extra mahadran. Okay, very nice. When you get married, and you have to drive 30 miles each way, and you have to pay the extra money, and you have to buy the freezer, ma tovu ma noyim. But now your mother has to do all of that, right? And you're becoming a little too heavy to carry for your mother to do this. So now you want to be solid gold, but if you're going to be too heavy for the people who have to carry you, then maybe you should not be solid gold and do what is perhaps not as mohoder. And when you are the one who's carrying yourself, then you'll be able to do the hither. If it would be that it was treif, so I would tell the mother, you have a big schus of helping out your daughter. But if it's not treif, it's just an extra hither, then if you're not the one who is paying for that hither, and you're not the one who is inconvenienced because of it, then maybe you shouldn't be mahadr, maybe the hither should be easier to carry than making somebody carry you who doesn't want to necessarily, right? But you're forcing them because you want to be extra solid gold, and then you're going to be too heavy to carry. Yeah.
It's a nice explanation, but it wasn't the arm. Didn't the arm carry itself?
Yeah, so he asked that. And he says, but that was a miracle. And ain somchem al anes. It had to be carryable naturally too, in case the nes didn't happen. So, but that lesson is there. Sometimes people want to do extra chumras or whatever, right? And someday we'll talk about chumras altogether, because sometimes they're very good and sometimes they're not so good because they're not really chumras. Because they lead a person to do worse if they're machmer. But that's not for now. But sometimes chumras is very nice. It would be very nice to have that hither of using chassidish shechita. But if you're not the one who is paying for it, you're not the one who's being inconvenienced for it, then to make somebody else inconvenienced because you want to be mahadr, maybe that's not a hither. And that's what we learn from the Aron. If the Aron could have been solid gold, but the people who had to carry it would have been too heavy to carry, then maybe the orange shouldn't be solid gold. It should be partly wood and partly gold on the inside and the outside in order to accommodate the people who had to carry it. That's what I told her. Okay. In any case, next. The next one is a longer thing. I think we have plenty of time. Okay. Let's go back to the Aron. The Aron, it said, is symbolic, the fact that it was gold on the inside and gold on the outside, that a Talmud Chacham should be Tocho, his inside should be like his outside. Which is implied to be first, the inside or the outside? Which comes first? The inside should be like the outside. Which one's first?
Outside.
The outside. Because we're making the inside like the outside. That means you start with the outside. And the inside then should be like the outside is. Just like the outside is gold, the inside should be gold too. Yeah? That's what it seems to say. The outside, the inside should be toho kibaro. The inside like the outside. That assumes that there's an outside for the inside to be like. So first you start with the outside, and then you make the inside like the outside. Shouldn't it be just the opposite? The outside is the chitzonius. How a Talmud Chacham looks on the outside. The inside is the pnimius. Wouldn't you say that it's more important that he work on his pnimius before he works on what kind of hat he wears and what kind of suit he wears and what he looks like on the outside? The Icarus should be that he's gold on the inside. It should have said, baro ketocho. Make the outside look like the inside. First work on your pnimius and become a real Talmud Chacham, and then appear on the outside as you are on the inside. So why does it say the opposite? Why does it say toho kibaro and not baro kitoho? So I'll tell you another story. I had a woman in my kehila who grew up in a very modern, I use modern, a very, here they have a good word for it, dati light. Right? They were frum, but not too, you know, not too serious about it. Meaning, they grew up frum, they were Shomer Shabbos in her parents' home. But, you know, Shabbos, if you don't, you didn't drive and you didn't answer the phone, you didn't turn on the lights, that was enough to know Hilchos Shabbos, Borer, and a million other things. Nah, that they never bothered with that. That was like too much. That's too many details. Kashrus, basically, they ate kosher. Anything that had a hechsher on it was okay. They weren't makbid, you know, it should be a good hechsher, whatever. In fact, if it had a K anywhere on the label, it was okay. Even if it was in the name of the product. There's a sheet like that, you know, don't be too frum. And as long as you're basically kosher, Shabbos, tznius, as long as you wear clothes, it's good enough. That was pretty much what she grew up with. And she was pretty much the same way until she had her first child. And then she started thinking, I'm a mother now, and I have to be a good example to my child. Do I want my child to grow up in an atmosphere that's not really honest of what Torah is? So she started learning, and she started improving. She first kashered her house and only brought in good hechsherim. Right, Sikon was very makbid that she knows the laws of kashrus and what's reliable and what's not. And then she worked on Shabbos, and her husband went along with this. They both learned, and they improved slowly but surely. And then they raised their level of Shabbos observance tremendously and learned Hilchos Shabbos. And so Shabbos and kashrus were the first things, and it took them a good number of years to really reach a very, very nice level. And then I called her in one day and I said, you know, you've really, really impressive of making yourself and improving your standards of Yiddishkeit. I think you're ready for the next project, tznius. That time in Miami, if people wore clothing, that was really fine. Most people did not dress tzanua, especially because of the climate or whatever. Didn't wear sleeves. 90%, 99% of the women didn't cover their hair. That was accepted, even from people talking about Shomer Shabbos people. The only people basically who covered their hair were the rabbi's wife and the what's it called, the mechanchim, right? Their wives or the mechanchos, teachers, they also. But otherwise, regular balabatim, there were one or two exceptions. Most of them did not cover their hair, married women. And they did not dress halachically tzanua. So I told her, I think that you're ready for the next shlav, that if you're serious about kashrus and serious about Shabbos, next thing is to be serious about tznius. She said, Rabbi, I'm not ready for that. Not because of me, but because if I dress like that, I will look like a Rebbetzin, and I don't feel like a Rebbetzin inside yet, and I don't want to be a hypocrite. I'm going to be presenting something externally that I'm not yet holding by internally. I don't want to be a hypocrite. I said, okay, let me tell you what that is like. Imagine a person who comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, I don't really feel happy. So if I get up and dance with the Torah, I'm a hypocrite, because I'm putting on a show. I'm looking like I'm happy, but I'm not really happy. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy. And as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. The guy will sit there till Tisha B'Av. He'll never get happy. You know how you get happy? You dance. And then you become happy. That's not a hypocrite. A hypocrite is somebody who wants to put on a show and doesn't want to get to the inside. But the way that we get to emotions is through motions. You go through the motions. You want to be happy? Dance. You'll dance, you'll become happy. If you sit and contemplate being happy, you'll never be happy. It's the externals that initiate the internals. That's all mitzvahs are like that. The Sefer HaChinuch says, Hachitzonios ma'orerim es ha'pnimios. All mitzvahs are, do external things, hopefully they'll bring you to the internal things. A hypocrite is somebody who doesn't want the internal things, who just wants to put on a show. That's a hypocrite. But somebody who wants to reach those internal things, but has to go through the motions to create emotions, that's the way you do it. I said, if you continue dressing immodestly, you're never going to feel modest. If you start dressing modestly, you'll feel modest on the inside. So if that's your goal, that's how to do it. Right? It's not that you're dressing like a Rebbetzin and you're a hypocrite because inside you don't feel like a Rebbetzin. You want someday to feel like a Rebbetzin, so dress like one. So dress modestly, you'll feel modest. If you walk around all day in a bikini, you're not going to ever feel modest. You're never going to come to that level of feeling modest by walking around immodestly. So that's why the Aron was Tocho Kibaro. You have to start with the outside. You can't start with the inside. It doesn't work like that. You first work on getting your inside, adjusted, right, and formed by going through the motions on the outside. That's how it works. Motions create emotions. Okay. But that's not how the Aron was made. That's how the rabbis say it. That's how the Chachamim say it. Tocho kibaro. But it says in the Torah, right, v'tzipisa oso zahav tahar, mibayis umichutz titzapenu. Which one's mentioned first? The inside. Mibayis, inside, and then michutz, and then the outside. Why did the rabbis turn it around? The Torah says, first do the inside, then do the outside. And the Rabbanan changed it around and said, the inside should be like the outside. Meaning you start with the outside and then get to the inside. Why did they change from what the Torah said? The answer, I think, is that the Torah didn't say that. There's three different stages. It says, v'tzipisa oso zahav tahar. You should cover it with gold. If it only said that, where would the gold be? Outside or inside? Outside. Huh? Outside. All the other kelim were covered on the outside. Right? Only the Aron was covered on the inside too. All the other shulchan, right, the mizbeach, whatever, was covered with metal on the outside. So if it just said v'tzipiso so zahav tahar, it would mean covered on the outside. Then it says mibayis, also on the inside. And then it says again bachut, michutz, on the outside. There are three stages. Outside, inside and then outside again. And let's see how that worked. It perfectly describes what they did. I told you the three boxes. Yeah? So first, they took the wooden box, put it down. They took the, what's it called, the big golden box, and they put the wooden box inside of it. Now the Aron is covered where? On the outside with gold. Okay, the wooden box is inside the big golden box, so the gold covers the outside of the Aron. Then they took the little golden box and put it inside the wooden box. Now it's covered on the inside. What was missing? The rim. You could see a sandwich. Now you have to cover the outside of the rib with gold again, so it's completely covered. So therefore, it's first outside, then inside, and then outside again. So it comes out, you start with the outside, like we said, and that leads you to the inside. So what's the purpose of the outside again? Let's go back to the guy in Simchas Torah. He dances, he's not happy, but he wants to get happy. So he dances on Simchas Torah to get happy. Now he's happy. Should he stop dancing? Why should he continue dancing? Because there's another idea. And that is, aside from using the outside to create the inside, the outside also expresses the inside. Now you can express your happiness by dancing. If you just sit there and bask in your happiness, it's not as real as expressing your happiness through dancing. It's more concrete. Therefore, I'll tell you, the Ramban, it doesn't sound like the Ramban, but I saw this Sfas Emes brings down this Ramban. I looked for it a little bit, I could never really find it, but the Ramban is in his Perush on Aseres HaDibros, not in his Perush Ala Torah. It's a separate work that he wrote, a Perush on the Aseres HaDibros, and that's where it's found, this Ramban. He quotes a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. Ma ta'iru u'ma ta'oreru esa ahava ad she'techpots. Which, the simple meaning of the pasuk is, do not arouse your love until it is desired. Till the right time. Ma ta'iru u'ma ta'oreru esa ahava ad she'techpots, unless it's the time has come. But the Ramban says it can mean the following. If you have a tremendous feeling of love, fear, very deep emotions to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, do not arouse them until you can put them into something, a chefetz, into something concrete. Don't leave them floating in the air, ethereal, abstract. Express them in something concrete. Like we said, you feel this tremendous simcha, tremendous love for the Rabbanu Shel Olam, dance. You can use the dancing to get to that feeling, and once you have the feeling, you can use the dancing to express it. Expressing emotions in a concrete way is higher than just feeling those emotions on the inside. To the point where Moshe Cordovero, the Kubel, said that the neshamas in Gan Eden look forward to Tchias HaMesim like we look forward for Mashiach. Because it's on a higher level to be a neshama inside a body where the body can express what the neshama feels than just to be a neshama in a spiritual world. It's a higher level for the neshama to be able to have a body to express itself. Which explains a very difficult Ramban. The Ramban, the big machlokus, whether Olam Haba is a spiritual world or a physical world. The Rambam holds that Olam Haba is what we call Gan Eden, the world of neshamos, after death, is Olam Haba, not because it's not a world that doesn't exist now, it's Olam Haba, l'achar hamavos. When after a person dies, his neshama goes to a spiritual world, that is Olam Haba, and ultimately that will be the place where all neshamas are forever, in a spiritual world. Tchias HaMesim is only a temporary thing. At some point, the neshamas that died will come back to life, and then their neshamas will once again go back to the spiritual world after a certain time. Why that's necessary is a different discussion. But the Ramban says no. Olam Haba is a world that doesn't exist now. It's not the world of neshamos. That's Gan Eden, Gehenna, it's a different world. Olam Haba is a physical world where people will have bodies and souls eternally. They ask on the Ramban, but it says that Olam Haba is Ein Lo Bo Achila, there's no eating, there's no drinking. It doesn't sound like a physical world. Says the Ramban, Moshe Rabbeinu went 40 days on Har Sinai, didn't eat and drink. He was still in his body. It's possible to have a body that doesn't need to eat and drink. So Olam Haba is a physical world, but it's a physical world where the body will be eternal. So the question they ask is, so what do you need a body for? In this world, you need a body to create a place where the neshama can be. Because if you don't have a body, you can't be in this world. But once you're in a world where the body doesn't need to eat and drink, what do you need a body for? Based on this idea, in this world, you need the body to create a base for the neshama. You need the external to create the internal. In the next world, you won't need that. The neshama will keep the body going. But you need the body to express the neshama. The neshama needs something to express itself. It needs a physical thing to express itself, because that's a much higher level. So the neshama will express all of its emotions through the body. And that's a higher level. Like we said, it's a much higher level to express your simcha by dancing than just to be happy and not to express it in a concrete way. So therefore, there's three levels. There's the level of, what's it called, of the outside creating the inside. And once you have the inside being expressed through the outside again. Okay? With that, I want to explain the following very difficult Gemara. The Gemara says like this. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to make the Mishkan, so he told him first to make the Mishkan, the building, and then to make the Aron and the Kelim, and the various vessels. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he told Bezalel, he changed it around. And he told Bezalel first to make the Aron and the Kelim, and then the Mishkan. Bezalel said, can't be. It's not the way of the world. The way of the world, you don't make your furniture and then build a house around it. First you build a house, and then you put the furniture inside. Because if I make the furniture first, where am I going to put it? Kelim Shani Oseleich, where am I going to put them? If I were the house. First you make the Mishkan, then you make the Kelim, and you put the Kelim in the Mishkan. Moshe said, you know what? You're right. And you were in the shadow of God, the Tzel Kel Hayisa, right? And that's why he was called Bezalel, because he was in the shadow of God. Two questions. How in the world did Moshe Rabbeinu make a mistake? Did he make a mistake? He had to be corrected by Bezalel? Then maybe Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake in a lot of other things in the Torah and nobody corrected him. It's impossible to say that. The Rebbe Shem gave the Torah through Moshe Rabbeinu. He made sure he didn't make any mistakes. And if Moshe Rabbeinu did it on purpose, like, you know, to fool Bezalel, how was he allowed to play around with the Torah? Thirdly, the word tzel, shadow, always signifies doubt. Shadow of a doubt. Light signifies clarity. He should have been called, you were in the light of God. You knew better than me. He should have been called Orkel, not Bezalel. You were in the shadow of God. Shadow is with his doubts. Therefore, I want to say the following. The Mishkan would have been, even if there wasn't a Chet HaEgel. But once there was a Chet HaEgel, the Mishkan served a second purpose, to be a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. So the Mishkan was supposed to be before the Chet HaEgel, but based on the fact that the Jews sinned, right, the Mishkan took on another aspect. Okay, there was an aspect of the Mishkan had there not been a Chet HaEgel, and a new aspect because there was a Chet HaEgel. God knows everything, and he knew that there was going to be a Chet HaEgel. His knowledge does not affect people's free choice, because God's knowledge is a different kind of knowledge, and therefore God can know, and still we can have free choice. How that is, it's a miracle. It's something we can't understand. Maybe someday we'll discuss why we can't understand it. But in any case, that's a fact. God knows, but it doesn't affect our free choice. However, says the Mishnah Chachma, if people know, that does affect free choice. That knowledge is in this world already. Therefore, The Rabbanu Shalom did not want Moshe Rabbeinu to even have a hint that there was going to be a major sin that would change the purpose of the Mishkan. Because if Moshe knew there's going to be a sin, it would affect the free choice of the Jewish people. They didn't sin yet. And here Moshe knows there's going to be a sin. And therefore, before the sin of the golden calf, what was the purpose of the Mishkan? It says, wherever you are in the world, you can feel God's presence. B'chol makom asher azkir eshmi avoi lecho v'rachticha. If it hadn't been for the sin of the golden calf, we would not need a Mishkan to be able to go there and feel God's presence. So what was the purpose of the Mishkan before the Chet HaEgel? Once you feel God's presence anywhere in the world, you go to the Mishkan and you express it through the Mishkan. Like we said, there's an idea of taking feelings and expressing them through gashmiyistika things. So you went to the Mishkan and you brought a korban and you had the menorah and the aron and the shulchan, and you were able to express that feeling of God's presence through material things. So which came first, the Mishkan or the Kelim, before the Chet HaEgel? The Kelim. The purpose of the Mishkan wasn't to arouse you to feel God's presence by being in this place, because anywhere you could feel it. It was to use the Kelim to then, what's it called, express God's presence. Not to feel it. Not to get to feel it. After the Chet HaEgel, once they showed they needed something physical to be able to feel God, to have an intermediary, then you couldn't feel God's presence everywhere. You had to come to the Mishkan first to let the Mishkan arouse you to God's presence, and then to use the Kelim to express that. But it was a two-stage thing. So then the Mishkan came first, and then the Kelim. When God told Moshe Rabbeinu about the Mishkan, it was before the sin of the golden calf. And he intimated to him that the Mishkan comes first and then the Kelim, Moshe would have said, what's going on? We don't need a Mishkan to feel God's presence. And he would have known that's going to be a sin. So God therefore obscured it to him, put him in the darkness, put him in the shade, and made it appear as if the Kelim came before the Mishkan. But God knew that there was going to be a sin of the golden calf, and ultimately they're going to have to build the Mishkan first. Bezalel heard about it after the sin of the golden calf. And he said, Lokach min hago shalolim, that's not the way the world is. You don't first make the furniture and then build the house. You need the house first. Because that's only after the sin of the golden calf. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, you know what? You're right. God put me in the dark and made me think that the Kelim come first, so I shouldn't know that there's going to be a sin. But you were Bezalel Kel, you understood that shade, that God obscured it to me, and you understood that really the Rabbanu Shalom meant first the Mishkan and then the Kelim, because God knew there was going to be a sin, and that's the way things are now. So that's why he was called Bezalel. He understood how the Rabbanu Shalom shaded Moshe Rabbeinu from the truth to make him think that the Kelim came first, so he shouldn't know there's going to be a sin. But after the sin, Bezalel saw clearly that first has to come the Mishkan and then come the Kelim. First you need to arouse the inside from the outside, and then you can express it on the outside again. Before the Chet HaEgel, you didn't need the outside to bring you to experience that. You can experience anywhere. You only needed the Kelim to express it. Wherever you got it in the world, you can then express it in the Mishkan. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu thought the first way, and Bezalel the Maisa corrected him, not because he made a mistake, but because God shielded him and made it obscure so he shouldn't really understand what's going to be, so he shouldn't know that there's going to be a sin.